Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I can't tell you what a privilege and an honor it is to be with men and women such as I spent the last 24 hours. It is incredible to be able to reach out and touch and feel and listen to and be with the people that started this whole deal. It's even more amazing that we have a man here that was in the Oxford group when Bill Wilson came in to the Oxford groups looking for a way to get sober. But we've got him here tonight, and his name is Jim. Jim.
Put these things down here. I want to see everybody. Well, Fred didn't tell you, but you wonder why I knew Bill Wilson. Well, I'm 93 years old, and I was... I have to tell you that so that you realize that I was in a position to know Bill. And, see, I was 6 years old when the Titanic went down. Because I'm the oldest speaker here tonight, I've been given a very unique privilege, and that is to introduce a very special guest here tonight. This person, they tell me, has come a great distance. And more than that, this person is 115 years old, 111 years old, it says here. 111. Would that person please stand? If you can't stand, raise your hand so we can recognize you. Wait a minute. Maybe there's a name here. Wait a minute. I'm sorry, but the person isn't 111 years old. It says they're ill. And... So they can't come to the meeting tonight. I'm sorry about that, you see. Well, it's one of those things. The other day I was going on the way to the airport, and I had a call on my car phone. And it was from my son, and he said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm on the Beltway." He said, "Well, we just heard on the radio that there's a car on the Beltway going the wrong way, and we want you to look out for it." I said, "Son, I got news for you. There's hundreds of them out here going the wrong way." So that's where I am tonight. I want you to fasten your seat belts now, because I'm going to take you back to a time to a point in time where there was no Oxford group. I mean, no AA meeting. It was all Oxford group. And, There was a time when Bill, Dr. Bob, myself, T. Henry, Henrietta Sively, Sam Shoemaker, Roland, Abby, all of those people were all in the Oxford group together. There was no AA program. I was in Texas recently, and I said this. And it was a lady on the first row held up her hand, and she says, "How about Al-Anon?" And I said, "No, there wasn't any Al-Anon either." I told her. So what I want to do tonight is to take you back to that time. Dr. Bob met the Oxford group, as I understand it, in the spring of 1933. Bill met the Oxford group in town hospital on a dry out period, December the 11th, Friday night, December the 11th, 1934. I met the Oxford group the next night in a YMCA in Frederick, December the 12th, 1934. So Bill's sobriety date was only one day more than mine. So what was the Oxford group? People will say, we hear a lot about the Oxford group, but what was the Oxford group? Well, the Oxford group was a one-on-one Christian evangelistic movement within the churches. 80% of the people in the Oxford group were church members. I guess 5% were ministers. And when Bill met the Oxford group, that's the reason he was with Sam Schumacher. I mean, he's mentioned with Sam a lot because in the Episcopal Church, the Oxford group was very, very strong. And, of course, Sam being there and Calvary Episcopal Church in New York, that was the headquarters for the Oxford group from 1930 to 1938. So that is the reason Sam Schumacher is mentioned so much with Bill in the early day. Now, Bill, till he met the Oxford group, of course you would know he was an atheist. Now, I told people that, and they said, we thought he didn't have any religion at all. But Bill had tried everything else, and nothing worked for him. So when he tried listening to God, when he gave his life to God, this was the last resort. Well, now, you say, well, what was different about the Oxford group? Why was this a revival within the church? We see most people never get beyond the point of their own sobriety in AA. People in church never get beyond the point of their own conversion. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. But it means that their experience was not multiplied into the life of another person. Now you have to understand that the Oxford group was a deeply moral and spiritual movement. And many people in the church didn't like it because it challenged them on their living. It was designed to take people into the next step of their Christian life. And keep in mind all the time that all the people we're talking about in the early day were not in AA. They were in the Oxford group. And we all operated the same way. Now, Frank Bookman, the leader of the Oxford group, brought three things to the Christian table. And one was the four standards, taken from the Sermon on the Mount. They were absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. This is what we all faced in the Oxford group. And then he had what they call two-way prayer, where in our prayer life, we were taught how to accept the thoughts that we came back into our mind as thoughts coming from God, based on these four things and our knowledge of the Bible, the things we knew to be right, our conscience. These were all things of setting up these things so that we knew that these things were definite things. And we wrote them down in those days. And the next point was restitution. Bill Wilson in the 12th step, that's amends. He called it amends, putting right what was wrong in your life. And this is what we all did. So when Bill went into the AA program, 12 steps and all this, he took everything from the Oxford group into the AA program. Now, this was all new to me when I was confronted with this in the YMCA that night. And my life was 180 degrees out of phase. with all of this. I started drinking when I was 5 years old. I used to get into my mother's dandelion wine, and I'd fill the bottles up with water then, so that she wouldn't know that I drank them. And then the first day at school, I took a pint of dandelion wine to school with me in my dinner pail. And I was drinking like Coca-Cola. I didn't know any difference. And I liked it. It was sweet. Had a nice taste. And I was very disappointed when they took it away from me that day. But when I was 12 years old, 1918, we started in what a period was called prohibition. And we had prohibition from 1918 to 1933. And so most of my serious drinking was done during that period. Well, we said, how did prohibition come about? Well, the First World War was on then. All the men were away to war, and the women got together and voted, and with the church people, they voted their liquor out of the country. That's the way it happened. That's exactly the way it happened. And you have to understand, it's hard to understand, but realize that there was no place where you could either drink or buy liquor publicly. Everything was underground. It was illegal. People, if you wanted to have a party, you went down in the cellar. And a lot of people had padded cellars. You couldn't hear them. You couldn't hear the noise that was coming out of that. But you have to understand that that's the way we were living then. And if you wanted to drink, you had two types of drinks. You had either rot gut liquor, or it was homebrew. Homebrew was a beer that we made in ourselves in the cellar. And if you put too much yeast in it, you would pop the tops off the bottles, and nighttime you'd hear these things coming up against the kitchen floor. Against this type of background, I came in touch with the Oxford group, and they began to talk to me about these four standards and about the thing of listening to God. I didn't understand this. And they said, well, they were very patient with me. They said, well, they told me a story of the man on the street with a violin case under his arm. And he asked another fellow, he said, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the man said, practice, man, practice. So they told me it's a matter of practice. You have to try this. And it was a challenge. So I tried it. And the first thought that came into my mind really startled me. The first thought that came was something that I had done 10 years ago. I had never thought of it once, and humanly I don't think I ever would have, but that was the first thought that came into my mind. And not only the thought about it, but the thought of putting it right. And the thing was that 10 years before that, I had taken a company car Saturday afternoon, picked up a friend, gone to a football game, got drunk on the way, ran into a car, and didn't stop. I came back, fixed up the little damage I had on my car, and then as an extra precaution, I got the man who owned the garage to say that I didn't have the car out. So sure enough, the next week they came to investigate. He said, well, there's a car. He said, not damaged, you can see. And he said, furthermore, he didn't have the car out. So they went away, and everyone had forgotten about the thing. Now, 10 years later, God is telling me to go back and to straighten this out. And which I did. I went back to the company, and they looked up the records, and they said, well, there wasn't any serious. It showed that there was some action there, but nothing serious. So they said, just forget about it. So I was happy about that. And the first thing I began to realize, and I began to get thoughts about dishonesty. I realized that alcohol was not my real problem. That my real problem was dishonesty. And so I worked for a power company at that time, and I got paid a salary, but I worked overtime, and I didn't get paid overtime. So I didn't see anything wrong at all about padding my expense account to get that extra money, which I did. And I had a jumper on my electric meter, and I was second in command of the engineering department. And I knew how to fix these meters. I worked in the meter department, and I don't think there's a meter out there now that I can't beat. And I tell this to people, and they say, "Will you show us how to do it?" Well, so then it was a matter of going back then and straightening that up. This fellow down here has got me on a time schedule, and I have to be careful. I have to be. There's lots of other things I'd like to tell you here tonight, I want to be sure to stay within this time limit, and so I began to realize that there was something in this Oxford group, and I began to see that this went way, way beyond a personal salvation. Is that Bookman had an instrument here by which people's lives could be used to bring something new into other people's lives. And I realized that there were many ways in which a person could become a good person, but in many cases the person is good for nothing. Now, I mean by that, how do you merchandise all this goodness that you get? You can practice being good, but how do you do this? But Bookman had a way, an outlet for us to take this into the lives of other people. Now, I was thinking of my story of my marriage. There was a small college in my hometown, a girls' school, and it was Hood College. And I met a girl there, and she only knew me the time she was in school. And I talked her into running off and getting married before she went home for the summer. I was only 24 years old. And so I wasn't ready for marriage at all. So we weren't married a month before I told her I was sorry I ever saw her. She was a proud girl. Her family had already investigated me, and they had told me they got a bad report back from the town fathers, and said I wasn't any good. So they told her that I wasn't any good. But before that, so she was too proud to go home and say, "You were right. This guy wasn't any good." So she decided to stick it out. So we were 4.5 years into armed truce marriage, going nowhere but downhill, when I met the Oxford group. And then things changed. It took me 3 days to get straight with her. Days where I'd come home from work, starting telling her about myself, being honest with her, and through dinner, after dinner, until we went to bed. Often after we went to bed, we talked. 3 days of that to really get straight with her. And she knew that it was a rough time. And she knew that she said to me this, she said, "It's hard for me to take this, but it's better for me to know this now and not have it come up later and spoil our marriage." She said, "So that we can start building a new home on a sound basis." And that's exactly what we did. Now, I met Bill Wilson in 1935 in the YMCA and Francis Scott Key. Bill came to our meetings there. He came to visit people in the area and for a weekend, and he heard we were having meetings. He came in, and the first thing he said to me, "Are you going to have any drunks here tonight?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, Bill." But he was absolutely obsessed with taking what he had found in the Oxford group into the AA program. He went to Sam Schumacher, Frank Bookman in 1937 and said, "I think I should give myself to alcoholics." And Frank said, "If that's the biggest thing you see for your life, Bill, go and do it." But he said, "Remember, we're dealing with alcoholic nations." So Bill left to work in 1937. And taking all of the principles. If you read the big book, it's just like reading Oxford group material. Bill's idea was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So he took everything in there. And the big book, I'm afraid, is often like a family Bible. It gets up on a shelf someplace and gathers dust, and it's there as a prestige item, but we really don't read it. You need to go back, and you need to read the big book. And that's why we're here tonight, is to get back to the basics that our forefathers started. The thing of measuring our life by four standards and listening to God. Now, Bookman always said that you can't, Bill's, make a new omelet with bad eggs. And he used to caution us that we said, "Well, we're just small people." He said, "Remember that big doors swing on little hinges." And he said, "Don't fight the problem, live the answer." And I remember we had a cartoon back in those days of a man coming back from a fishing trip. He had fishing poles on his back, but no fish. And he said he hadn't caught any fish, but he had influenced a lot of them. we had a saying in the Oxford group that if you're not winning, you're sinning. And we were out there to really get converts into the Oxford group, just like Bill in the early days getting converts into the AA program. And the work was always based on living out those four standards of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, and the listening to God. Now, this is more than a life about alcohol. Alcohol is only mentioned, remember, in the first of the 12 steps. Everything else is on a moral and spiritual issue of life. And they used to tell us that you can plan a new world on paper, but you have to build it with people, changed people. The people who are willing to let God talk to them about every area of their life are the ones who are going to be used to build a new world. Now, we can't create something new in the world unless we create something new in ourselves. And we can't give away something that we never had. I think the hope of the future lies not in better human inventions, but in better human relationships. Now, this brings us to a point in our life where we have to evaluate our own life. Now, I would like to read to you tonight a letter that was there was a fella in the Second World War who had the thought from God to write home. He had a premonition that he was going to get killed. And he wrote incessantly, inspiring letters. And I want you to read I want you to read the last letter that he wrote home, and it's this. He said, "Suppose we as a nation find again the faith our fathers knew. Suppose our homes again become the nation's strength, our schools the centers of true learning and good citizenship, our farms and factories the pattern of unity, integrity, and national service. Suppose our statesmen learn again to listen to the voice of God. Then we shall know once more the greatness of a nation whose strength is in the spirit of her people." His name was John Hogan. The day after he wrote this letter, he was killed in action. Now, we in AA have a chance to give our lives in a similar way. Our life of alcohol, we can give up. I'm thinking of a man, tonight. His name was Henry Wright. He was one of the early professors of religion at Yale University in New Haven. He had inscribed on the wall of his classroom these words, and these are the words: "The world has yet to see what can be accomplished by, with, for, and through one person totally committed to doing the will of God." And then he would always ask his class this question. And I'm going to ask the question here again tonight. And the question is this: will you be that person? Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Started us off in a very positive way. Our next speaker is a man that I met in Tyler, Texas a few years back. And I had a guy I used to like to listen to his tapes, and I was being introduced to his wife. And someone came up and introduced Searcy to me. And they said, "This is Searcy, he was Evie's sponsor." And I had to make a decision who I was going to talk to, and unfortunately, Wino Joe's widow won out. And later on, I had to go looking for Searcy to make sure I met this man and shook his hand. And he's just a delight. So we're happy to have him here tonight, 53 years sober. And every year down in Dallas, he has a little deal called the Gathering of Eagles. And if you've got 40 years plus of sobriety, you can show up there on Sunday morning and speak. Last year, I think I had the total. Searcy told me that that particular convention, they had 6,000 years of sobriety. So here he is, Searcy W.
Yeah, with all that applause, I can hardly wait to hear what I've got to say. You know, the mind can absorb in about as much as the rear end can stand. Let's stand up just a minute and rest our rear end. Just stand up just a second. Come on. Yeah, be seated. Yeah, my name is Cersei, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the help of all of you people, Al-Anon and Al-Ateen and Al-Tots and Al-Tors, and all in between, I have not had a, or found it necessary to take a drink since May 10th, 1946. And, and the only reason I mention the length of my sobriety is because I'm damn proud of it. That's the only reason I talk about it. We're gathered here because we're faced with the fact that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable. But with the help of God, they are manageable. Thank God. So I'm not here because I'm 53 years sober. I'm not here because we had a convention. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic and I found the way to sobriety and joyous, happy living through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only reason I'm here to... I'm here, if it's possible, to carry this message to those who still suffer. And if we ever forget what our primary purpose is, we're a lost cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help somebody else stay sober, right? And as far as I'm concerned, that's the end. You know, Carl Sandburg said one time, whenever a society or civilization perishes, there is always one condition present. They forgot where they came from. And we're here to celebrate the 60th birthday of the writing of the big book and the publishing of the big book. And like Bob said, you know, I'm so glad we have the big book, and I'm so glad that old Rockefeller, when Bill needed some money to print the big book with, he turned him down. He said, the only way I can hurt this thing is to give it money. And like Bob often said, we talk about, imagine if Rockefeller had given those 100 first members of Alcoholics Anonymous $1 million, and it'd been $100,000 each, and we wouldn't have any AA. Well, I'm not going to have a drunk along or tell you, you know. We had a guy in our group the other night that talked 2 hours and 45 minutes, and when he got through, he's still in the same bar. He went through several wives and divorces and divorce counseling and all that. Bob and I had an agreement, Bob Smith and I had an agreement, that we're going to try to talk about the solutions. What's the problem? We know what the problem is. Hell, we drank too much and did too many things that, in our lives that we didn't like. And that's the problem. But the solution is, that I found, is through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. Yeah, that's where I found it. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit, though, about myself. You know, I've got some good measurements. These are not my measurements of my body. I'm 89 years old. I've been married to the same woman for 65 years. I've been sober 53 years. I was raised out in West Texas. A sorry damn country. And I was raised on a farm. And it's a sorry damn farm, too, I'll tell you. There were seven of we children in my family, and I did not inherit alcoholism, I'll tell you that. My father, mother, grandfather, nobody in my family ever had the problem of drinking until I came along. And I had two brothers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of them, sober 35 years, died. The other was 28 years, and he died. But it did not run in my... I did not inherit alcoholism. I developed alcoholism in the process of, because I have an X factor in my life, whatever the hell that is, I don't care. but you add alcohol to it in large doses over a various period of time, and you cross that line into compulsive pathological drinking. And that's the only kind of drinking that's a disease to me. So I finally got to leave that farm, and I had an old aunt up in Stamford, Texas. I'm getting in a bigger town now, about 1,500. And I finished high school there, and I'd played a lot of sandlot baseball, and I had a contract when I finished high school to go to Midland, Texas, in the oil field. They were developing the oil field in West Texas, and a lot of oil out there, and a lot of money. And they would hire people to play, like Guy and myself, play baseball, but we had to work, we had to have a job. And so I went out there to play with this baseball team. And they made me work for a large motor company out there. And I worked on everything in that motor company. They taught me how to do these things, you know. A kid like me off the farm, I didn't know how to do anything except chop cotton or something like that. However, back to my father and mother, I learned some things from them that stayed with me, and they were the cause of me eventually recognizing that there is a power greater than I am, and that's God. My dad used to have prayer meeting on Sunday night, and he and my mother would get on their knees and pray. I thought it was kind of silly, but I heard him pray for our neighbors that I knew damn well he didn't like. He prayed for them in the hope that they would straighten their lives out and do something with their lives, you know. But anyhow, in this playing baseball, I was a pitcher of a sort. And this is semi-pro ball now. And, Our baseball manager, you know, I never did like to drink with a sorry drinker. I don't know about you. I'd like to drink with somebody, just drink and drink and drink, puke it up and drink some more. These people that say, you like my wife, you know, she'll drink a grasshopper. Whatever the hell that is, I don't know. But she'll sip on it and we'll finish eating and it's still sitting there. It's a damn waste of money. You know, and I like to drink it down. We had a guy named Red Hill that was our third baseman. And Red was a sorry drinker. He would drink two or three drinks and just pass out. He couldn't handle alcohol at all. Nothing like me. Nothing. Well, our baseball manager was Doc Ellis, and Doc had a funeral parlor. And every Sunday night after the baseball game, we'd go to the funeral parlor and drink home brew and act silly. And like all drunks do, you know. And this night at the funeral parlor, old Red had about two or three beers. We drank home brew then. And I know most of you don't know what home brew is, but it's some kind of macaroni and cheese or something. It's fermented. It'll make you drunk. Red had a couple of bottles of beer and passed out. And we were disgusted, we who could handle alcohol, with Red. And so after a while, we decided we'd teach him a lesson. And we picked him up and put him in a casket. And we folded his arms and put all the flowers on him and everything. And we stood back to listen what his reaction would be. And then we heard Red say, he reached and felt himself and looked up and all around. He said, well, if I'm not dead, why am I here? And if I am dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom? You can imagine Red later on came in the program. Well, we played baseball. We didn't have big stadiums like you did, like the Giants Stadium and all those. No, We played out, that's a ranch country, and we played out in the cow pasture. And if you knocked a home run, you'd have to hit it a mile to go over one of those fences, you know, out there. But in that cow pasture, what ended my career one time, I slid into what I thought was third base. And I quit playing baseball. They gave me a job with this motor company, and I did well with it. And they promoted me to manager and general manager. We had everything from Abilene, Texas to El Paso, about 600 miles, distributors for Dodge trucks. And in those days, you don't know what you, I see your smog here, but you don't know, that doesn't compare to the sandstorms in West Texas. Those clouds of dirt and dust would come into West Texas and it would tear up a motor on an automobile. So Chrysler put an oil filter on. He smarted them out. And we sold the hell out of those Dodge, those oil companies, big oil companies, pipeline companies, bought them. And so I had a good job, a lot of money, and I had to do a lot of entertaining. You can understand that, you know. And I entertained and entertained and day and night and day and night. I'm talking about the road to alcoholism now. And you keep following that pattern, and if you have that whatever that is in there and go on somewhere down the line, your drinking pattern changes. Something happens. What the hell is the difference? I could drink and go to work, no problem, no hangover, no nothing. And now, it's hard. It's different. What's happened? And so, I'm on the road to compulsive pathological drinking. And you keep that pace up and you keep it up. If you do, then you really get into it. And I got on those four horses. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I rode them out. I stayed with that. Well, here, you know, after so long, your luck changes, for one thing. Do you ever notice how your luck changes when you get to where you can? I started working for a narrow-minded employer. And then I decided I'd take the geographical cure. So I went from Midland to Corpus Christi, Texas, as credit manager of the Packard Automobile Company. It's a sorry damn car, but they were cutting me off the other. And I took the geographical cure. That's unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I got to Corpus Christi, and my drinking got worse. And make a long story short, I got in trouble with my boss. I'd take that old Packard and go out on the King Ranch. It was 360,000 acres out there. I'd go out there loaded with whiskey and just drink, stay out there 4 or 5 days. And I was on a very strict diet, as most alcoholics were, cheese and crackers and booze, you know. That's all I had. Well, anyhow, I found out that the Packard people were very narrow-minded, and they fired me. And I tried to get other jobs. Here's what happens. You keep going down and you're bewildered. You don't know what the hell happened. But the further you go, the worse it gets, and then you get into that terrible situation where you don't know, you can't get out, you can't get in, you don't know what to do. And I hired out to the wrong kind of person. I finally hired out to a guy that had some pickle trucks. They served with hamburger joints. And you say, take a CEO like me driving a damn pickle truck? A big shot like me driving, oh my God. So I got out of the city to drive this truck, and on the way to Mexico, we stopped at the hamburger joint and they were closed. We went on to Mexico, another drunk with me. And I traded that load of pickles and onions for booze. And came back, and, you know, I found out the police were narrow-minded. They put me in jail. My brother bailed me out, and I went to Dallas. And I went to work at a defense plant. out in Dallas. And we alcoholics are pretty sharp, you know. We know phonies when we see them. And they put me studying time out there, what these people were doing with their time. And I discovered in my very way of looking into their time that a lot of them were going to lose the world, World War II, if we didn't get something done. So I volunteered to go in the service. And boy, that's a mistake. When you're 33 years old, you've been sober about 20 years, been drunk 20 years, and you're out of gas, and you're out there trying to do basic training, believe me, you better watch out. I wound out in some terrible places, a terrible time. I went in the service, and they sent me to Cheyenne, Wyoming, the most terrible place in the world. And I stayed there 11 months, and I didn't do any drinking and basic training because I couldn't breathe. And when I got out of there, I went back to Dallas, Texas, and immediately they hired me for five states with Electric Auto Light Company out of Toledo. And they moved me to Lubbock, Texas. And I went out there. They knew I had a drinking problem, but they didn't know how bad it was, really. Anyhow, on a day there, and I was traveling with my salesman, the distributor salesman, and we were in a little town, Odessa, Texas, out there. And I had to have a drink. I was about to die. And I told this guy that his car broke down, I said, I'm going to the hotel while you're having the car fixed. And on the way, you see, an alcoholic's smart. I knew there's a liquor store between there and downtown. So I went and got me a pint of whiskey. And I ran into an old drinking buddy of mine, Bob Skimmerhorn, who I had done a lot of drinking. He was a sorry drinker, too, but he had a lot of money. And I ran short. I know none of you ever did, but I ran short of money a few times, now and then. Well, I'd steal his money, and he'd pass out, and I'd steal his money, and I'd just stay drunk. He kept me drunk about 10 years. But I ran into Bob, and I hadn't seen him in some time, and I said, let's go have a drink. I'm about to die. And he said, I'll go with you. We went up the room, and we talked a little. And he said, I'm not drinking today, but you need a drink. Going, you're in bad shape. Go on and drink, have you a few drinks. And I asked him what kind of venereal disease he had. You know, it must be something. I'd never seen him turn a drink down, never. Well, anyhow, he said, here's what happened. I'd get up and drive at night and drink. And in front of the airport, where the old airport is now, he said, I ran into a carload of ladies, and three of them were killed. And you can imagine the anguish my mother and the problems we've had. And the anguish of having killed somebody drunk. It was the most terrible thing you ever heard of. And he said, I found a bunch of guys there in Dallas, and we meet and together, and I found a way not to drink. And I've been sober 10 months. And I said, my God, that's impossible. No way he could stay sober 10 months. But anyhow, he said, I'll send you this book. I want you to read it. It's a big book, and wherever you'll be next week. No, he said, I'll send it to you home. I said, don't send it there. My wife think I had a drinking problem. And he sent it to Amarillo, Texas, in the hotel. And I was drunk. And you know, I had that big book, and I thumbed through it 500 times. Never did read it, but I stayed drunk. Isn't that amazing? I never did read it. I didn't know what was in it. But I took it home, hid it from my wife, I thought, and she read it and put it back and waited. She said, that sounds good, but he'll never do that. Well, anyhow, Bob told me on that occasion, when you go as far as you can go, you can't go another step, you call me. Come to see me. I'll try to help you. You need some help. And so I lost that job in November. Another narrow-minded employer. And the
And I stayed drunk every day from the latter part of November 45 till April of 46. And that moment of clarity came. When that sunlight of the Spirit, something happened. And it said, you better go look up Bob. You've gone as far as you can go. And I got on the plane, went to Dallas, and Bob was out of the city, so I got some more drunks. And we got drunk, stayed drunk until Saturday, and he came and took me in an ambulance out to a drying up joint. We didn't have recovery centers like we do now. But I was there, and they'd give us an ounce of whiskey every 4 hours. And I'd been drinking a pint every 4 hours. So you can imagine how much good that was doing. This old Irishman in there said, listen, sir, if you will, in the morning, turn that drink down, and that'll be today. And if you turn that, and if you don't ever take a drink today, you'll never take another drink. Well, I said, well, I'll be damned, now you tell me. I turned that drink down, and for some unknown reason, I didn't need a drink. I don't know why, I'd always had to have a drink. But they took me to AA, and we went downtown Dallas to 912 and a half Manning Park in front of a liquor store. And then I knew AA had worked. You know, when they told me to take me to AA and park in front of the liquor store, that'd work. That'd be all right. Well, we went upstairs, and there were 10 guys in there, all happy, joyous, and free, and they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here is where God intervenes and helps sometimes. There was only one guy in all those 10 that could have done what he did and show me a way that I did not have to drink on a daily basis. He took me to the 12 steps. There were no 12 positions then. He took me to the step and said, do you believe in God? I said, yes, I believe in God. He said, I want you to commit in the morning before you get up that you not, I don't want your promises, your propositions. A commitment to God that you will not take a drink just for 24 hours. And he gave me the solution, and there were only 4 members of Alcoholics Anonymous between Fort Worth, Texas and Phoenix, Arizona, 1,500 miles, not a group. And there were only 4 members. Well, finally we developed some groups, and by going back and forth to Dallas and AA had just begun in that country. And so we had groups, they mushroomed, and all of a sudden we had a lot of groups, and the thing was working, and AA was working good. And Bill Wilson would come to Texas and help us down there get some groups to where it's a lonely thing when you don't have a group, have people. That's the reason I need you people. So, as we went along, you know, we formed clubs. We are the cause in the Southwest of having the 12 traditions, because we had clubs, and they called them AA clubs. And it's not, you know, old Mary ran off with the money, and old John trying to run the club. No, and we kept Bill Wilson awake all night. You know, they were calling New York and find what the hell we're going to do with John and Mary. And so Bill would come to Texas. And then in 1948, Bill came to Amarillo, Texas. We had about 25 people gathered in Lubbock, Texas. They came to Amarillo, and we got in the plane and went, and he pulled out some notes. And he said, I want you to read these and see what you think about them. And then I read them over carefully, and I said, Bill, this is all right for you Yankees, all right. But we don't need it down here. We love each other. Oh, how we love each other. What it was the 12 traditions. Aren't you glad I didn't start this thing? Well, anyhow, Bill was there. Many times, many trips, Bill came to visit with us and showed us how to solve these situations and what to do about it. And so Anyhow, Bill sent me off to Yale School on alcohol studies after I raised hell with him so long and asked him so many questions. And I went there and got all this knowledge and came home, you know, and I was going to save everybody. And so after a while, after a couple of years, Dr. Jelinek hired me, and they brought the Yale School on Alcohol Studies to Fort Worth, TCU. And then after a while, they hired another guy and myself to do educational work, to establish local committees for education on alcoholism and so forth. And in about, to make a long story short, I think we spread the disease pretty good. After a while, then Dr. Jelinek became ill. Dr. Jelinek was a scientist, and he came from South America to head the Yale School at New Haven. And we were riding along one day, and I said, Bunky, you're a banana scientist, and then you go to alcohol. How in the hell do you go from bananas to alcohol? He said, they're just alike. They get away from the bunch and get peeled. And so anyhow, there came a time Dr. Jelinek became ill, and he said, the greatest need we have is some hospitals where an alcoholic can go into and sober up and go into AA and stay sober. And so we started some hospitals. And long story short, because I don't have very much time, a long story short, Bill came to visit this clinic we had in Dallas one time. And in 1953, and I said, Bill, what would you rather see happen now in AA that's never happened? He said, I'd rather see Abby have a chance to get sober. Abby went to Bill. Bill was in the hospital, Towns Hospital, you know, for the 40th time, and he was in the Oxford group. And Bill said, what's this religion you got? He said, well, it's not religion, it's spirituality. Well, what do you do? What's the bottom line? He said, we trust God, clean house, and help others. And we haven't been able to improve on that since then. You know, it's still that way. So, anyhow, we got A.B. down, sobered him up, and A.B. stayed sober off and on 3 or 4 years at a time. But to make things straight, he finally died up in upstate New York here. And he was sober 2.5 years when he died. But he had periods of sobriety, 3.5, 4 years. He nursed, and he was crazy about women like I am. And he fell in love with this RN, a nurse, and he nursed her for 2.5, 3 years. She was hopeless and helpless. And then he got drunk when she died. So, we've learned a lesson in these things. How, you know, I see the threads of spirituality woven through all of the program of the fabric of AA. It's all through there, from the beginning, from everything that happened, like for the things we got from the Oxford group and so forth. It all reverts back to the power greater than we are. And these 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous were not written by somebody that sat down and wrote out 12 steps. They did those things, and as a result, they stayed sober. How do we know AA worked? It worked because it worked from the beginning. Why? Because it's what they did. And those who did those things and experienced those steps stayed sober. And those who didn't, didn't. And that's true today. So, I wish I had 2 or 3 days. We might have made a lot of mistakes in alcoholic, a lot of mistakes. And we did things wrong in a lot of cases, most cases. But here are the things, we talked about the things to do to stay sober. I'm going to tell you about how not to stay sober and how we didn't stay sober in the beginning. And these are the 12 steps prior to the AA program. We admitted we were powerless over nothing, that we could manage our lives and perfectly and those of anyone else who would allow us to. We came to believe there was no power greater than ourselves and the rest of the world was insane. We made a decision to have our loved one friends turn their will and lives over to our care, even though they couldn't understand us at all. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of everyone we knew.
we admitted to the whole world at large the exact nature of everybody else's wrong. We were entirely ready to make others straighten up and ship out. We demanded others to either shape up or ship out. We made a list of all persons who had harmed us and became willing to get even with all of us. We got direct revenge on such people wherever possible, except when to do so would cost our lives and the very least the jail center. We continued to take the inventory of others, and when they were wrong, promptly and repeatedly reminded them of it. We sought through bitching and nagging to improve our relations with others, and we couldn't understand them at all, asking only that they knuckle down under ours. Having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of these steps, we tried to blame it on others and to get sympathy and pity in all our affairs. I know it. But I've got to read that. We had early promises, too. And Fred almost stole my thunder out of my book. So here are the early promises. You'll know your full name and address. You'll be able to shave yourself. You'll be able to dress and undress yourself at the appropriate time and places. You will at all times know the city, state, and country you're in. You will routinely be able to find matching socks. You'll be able to smoke if you wish without burning the holes or cleaning the clothes or furniture. You'll lose the fear of food. You will spend less time in the bathroom. You'll be able to walk a straight line past the balloon test. You'll lose the fear of police cars in your rearview mirror. You'll be able to answer the doorbell without looking through the keyhole first. You'll realize what a mess you've been and thank God for AA and Al-Anon. Now the rewards. These are the real rewards. And you can put your zero up then. These are the real rewards. Faith instead of despair. Courage instead of fear. Hope instead of desperation. Peace of mind instead of confusion. Real friendship instead of loneliness. Self-respect instead of self-contempt. Self-confidence instead of helplessness. A clean conscience instead of a sense of guilt. The respect of others instead of their pity and contempt. A clean pattern of living instead of a purposeless existence. The love and understanding of our families instead of their doubts and fears. The freedom of a happy life instead of the bondage of an alcoholic obsession. So I'm going to take a little more time, about a minute. I know I spoke over in England their 50th anniversary over there in 1997, and they talked 20 minutes over there, and that's the maximum. Nobody ever talked over, no matter who you are, you know. And so I barely got to introduce myself over there. But there is no doubt in my mind that, and this is experience, strength, and hope, that the answer to all of our problems as an alcoholic, the solution is to experience the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't mean read them and know them and talk about them, just experience like our founder did. Experience those things. And as a result, they stayed sober. So, old Bill told me one time, I said, why are we talking about Abby? And he said, and Abby asked me to be his sponsor before he died several times. He was sober 2.5 years before he died. And we talk about those things and how nobody is hopeless and helpless in this fellowship. There is not anyone, anywhere, anytime that cannot be helped by someone. And each and every one of you out there are the only one who can help somebody that's looking for a way out. You're the only one can do it. Nobody else. You can. Each one of you. There's somebody you can help. So, don't leave, I'm not going to sing this song. But back to Stamford, Texas, there was a guy named Stuart Hamlin that wrote a lot of songs, and he went to Hollywood and wrote a lot of religious songs for those religious movies. And he came into Alcoholics Anonymous about 3 years before he died and asked me to be his sponsor, and I told him, I thought he wrote, you've heard his old song, some of this old house, and things like that, and he wrote this, it is no secret what God can do. And these are the words, I'm not going to sing it, don't leave. The words go something like, the chimes of time ring out the news another day is through. Someone slipped and fell, was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength, your courage to renew. Do not be disheartened, because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. There is no night, for in his lights you'll never walk alone. You'll always feel at home wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. If you're not as close to God as you once were, make no mistake about who moved. And if you never were close to God, make no mistake about who should move. So I challenge each and every one of you, all of us together, that we come to the realization that we have the greatest way to rid ourselves of the rubbish and trash in our lives that we don't want in there and remove the need to have alcohol in our lives. We have that program. That's the solution. And let's hold on to it. Let's keep it. Let's keep it. So I challenge each one of you, let's abandon ourselves to God as we understand God. Clear away the records of the past. Admit our faults to our fellows. And I have no doubt in my mind that whoever you are, wherever you came from, wherever you've been sober or anything about it, that all of us someday, somehow, somewhere, will meet again. Until then, God bless all of you and I love you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.